Well, you've heard about the topic of, quote, federalism, unquote, from a Yankee political point of view and from a Canadian Harvard point of view. I would have preferred it was Canadian Yale, but then that's the way it goes. Now you're going to hear it from a Southern partisan point of view. And I'm not sure that it's federalism. It may, in fact, be anti-federalism that we're going to be hearing about. All you need to know about Tom Landis are the following facts. First, he got his BA and his MA from Vanderbilt. He got his Doctor of Philosophy from the University of South Carolina. He's been academic dean of the University of Dallas. And he's, of course, as I suggested, associate editor of Southern Partisan Magazine. He's had hundreds of publications, including many articles and reviews, appearing in such publications as Hillsdale Review, D, Chronicles of Culture, Pace, Occasional Review, Intercollegiate Review, Modern Age, and many others. He tells me that his most scholarly work is a full-length treatise on garage sales and flea markets. With that in mind, I ask you to please give a warm welcome to Thomas Landis.
Let me say at the beginning that this is not entirely serious. One of the eventual casualties of the French Enlightenment was a shade of temperament in the American character, inherited from the Anglo-Saxons, a tendency to find in the supreme moment of exaltation cause for alarm, grief, even despair. You may remember that when Beowulf finally kills Grendel's mother, he is honored at a banquet which everyone expects to be the occasion of unrelieved rejoicing. Instead, his host, King Hrothgar, publicly warns the hero against the sin of pride, reminding him that sooner or later, the good Lord will notice his extraordinary fortune and do something perfectly awful to him. Indeed, the entire epic is a catalog of great deeds interspersed with previews of horrors to come. Ravaged mead halls, grandchildren murdered, civilization itself to be sifted through by lizards and spiders. It's a wonder that Beowulf bothered to finish his Salisbury steak that night, much less to charge once more into the Scandinavian morning, its sky so blue you'd think the east wind would never blow again. It's in the spirit of that remonstrance, which was delivered out of respect for weird or fate, that I, more than in rebuke of Beowulf, that I would like to explore for a few minutes the reasons why some of us are worried about the outcome of the November election. By some of us, I suppose I mean some Southern conservatives. Maybe some provincial conservatives everywhere. Those of us who will not be satisfied, indeed who've been unhappy since the Democratic Convention abolished the two-thirds rule. When was that, Mel? Yeah. Southerners have never been happy since that moment. We vote Republican in national elections these days, but we're like small-town Baptists at a New York cocktail party. We know what we're doing is perfectly all right, but we still feel uncomfortable about it. First, we're worried about the ambiguity of the president's victory, and we can't help but blame him a little for it. He might have done more with his extraordinary popularity than merely put it in the bank and watch it draw interest. The Senate, by consensus, will be more liberal after the election than before. The House is only a little better than it was after the losses in 1982. Reagan's coattails, say Messrs. Rather, Jennings and Brokaw were not nearly as long as Republicans had hoped. The way we see it, President Reagan did not even wear a coat. Instead, he traveled around the country in a t-shirt, silk screened with his own name and the slogan, "The World's Greatest Guy." As a result, we will never see the passage of the Reagan Social Program. Really no more than a legislative and executive reassertion of traditional principles ignored or abolished by the High Court. The president probably won't even try. And the nation is the immediate loser, as well as those candidates who might have been elected had he bestirred himself in their behalf. But the president himself will be the ultimate loser as well, despite his record victory. For by allowing the opposition to do so well in these other races, he has rendered himself impotent in the process. Unable to do more than scold or entreat, he will in all likelihood waste his remaining days negotiating compromising spending bills and dozing on the throne, his 525 electoral votes sparkling like rhinestones in his crown, as he dreams he's just won the Battle of Armageddon. All of this we find distressing, despite the fact that we never expected for him to make good on most of his attractive promises. So why did we vote for him in such overwhelming numbers? Perhaps this story will illustrate something of our old hope and despair in such matters. True story. A Texas city councilman whose successful campaign I had managed, Mel Bradford knows him, decided next to run for county commissioner against a popular incumbent. And knowing that South Dallas held the balance of power, I suggested that he go down to the preacher of the largest Baptist church and ask for his support. Afterwards, wild with grief, he told me why he decided not to run. It seems that the preacher had told him gently but firmly that the members of his congregation would support the incumbent. When asked why, he explained, "Mr. Roy told us that after this election, he's going to send a county crew out to our church and put on a new roof. It won't cost us a penny." "But he can't do that," protested my friend. "It's against the law to use county workers and county materials for anything except public projects." The preacher smiled sadly. "We know that," he said. "But the way Mr. Roy tells it, it sounds so good." That sums it up. Though we really don't expect anything from the president's new administration, the way Mr. Ron tells it, it sounds so good. He speaks of the America we all remember wistfully. He speaks of golden days forever in the past, when life was simple, hearts truer, and when we sang in the evening by the moonlight, "Roddy Doodah." This idea that we can return to virtues that have been handed down from generation after generation, from men as remote and austere as George Washington, Thomas More, and Cato the Elder. When people say that modern times bring modern problems that demand modern solutions, we don't listen. We don't want to hear that kind of talk. We want to hear promises made in a rush of renewed faith, the kind that brings people to the mourning bench, determined against all reason to amend their lives. We like to be told, for example, that prayers will be returned to school, despite the fact that such talk drives many of our fellow conservatives to distraction. We know it's impractical, that the casualties would be high. As a matter of fact, some of us early agreed that the issue of prayer in schools was indeed foolish ground on which to fight a major battle. As children, we stood uncomfortably on one foot and then the other while a homeroom teacher read a prayer from a sheet of daily announcements fresh off the hectograph. And all the while, we wished we were somewhere else. No one was ever caught up in a religious ecstasy at our school. No one heard the voice of a sectarian god speaking out of those bland words. No one even listened. At best, we were anesthetized. At worst, slightly embarrassed. So why, some of us asked, should religious leaders care if prayers in school are abolished by whim of the U.S. Supreme Court? God remained in his heaven, still accessible to those who were interested. On the other hand, it seemed even more absurd to argue, as did Madeline Murray O'Hare's attorney, that a child could in any way be deprived of unalienable rights or significantly traumatized by a few Our Fathers. If the O'Hare kid so reported, then he lied. And his attorney, in repeating the story, also lied, for surely he knew better. Imagine, if you will, little O'Hare at 8:25 on the spring morning, standing while the entire class mumbles the Lord's Prayer. Imagine in the middle of the recitation one of his schoolmates suddenly noticing that O'Hare's lips are not moving. He shouts accusingly and points his finger. All of the other children take up the cry. They gather around the offender shouting names like agnostic and demon. A raw-boned hand grabs him by the throat. Another rips the cord from a Venetian blind and fashions it into a crude noose. Now that's nonsense. Nothing is so easy as to stand smug and silent in contempt while a middle-aged woman reads a hectographed prayer. The idea that a human soul is somehow being violated by such an act is raw material for a Jonathan Swift. One is reminded of Ben Bolt's old friend, Sweet Alice, who wept with delight when you gave her a smile and trembled with fear at your frown. Is public school really the place for such delicate sensibilities? Now, the next thing, the Supreme Court's going to be outlawing the singing of Smarty, 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 thought you had a party. My point is that when the Supreme Court, in response to a good deal of intellectual prodding, ruled that prayers in school violated the First Amendment, we had reached a new level in the evolution of the ideological state. We were no longer talking about substantive matters, about palpable injustice. Court had adjourned in the real world and reconvened in cloud cuckoo land. And living as they were in that improbable world of ideas, the justices and their popular defenders had to insist that they were talking about life as it was really lived in the United States of America. And so they began to invent a country more suited to their purposes, not unlike the fanciful kingdom that the Bronte children made up in order to escape a miserable childhood on the Yorkshire moors. The USA of the justices had its own history, mythic heroes like Thomas Jefferson to justify the historic decision. And here is where some of us began to realize that we were wrong in assuming that the banning of prayers in school was at worst a petulant misdemeanor. Suddenly we were hearing television reporters on news programs like 2020 telling Americans that any attempt to restore prayers to the classroom was an assault on principles held sacred by the founding fathers and handed down to the present in inviolable continuity. It was almost as if they wanted those of us over 40 to forget that we never said prayers in school, or that generation after generation of Americans had done the same thing since the first days of the Republic. to listen to Henry Steele Commager, a teenager might be led to believe that Thomas Jefferson actually opposed religious exercises in state-sponsored schools. The phrase wall of separation became as familiar to this generation of Americans as love is never having to say you're sorry. It's significant to note the degree to which judicial plotters like Hugo Black suddenly became infatuated with metaphor, as if they knew their legal constructions were more akin to Elizabethan pastoral than to Blackwood. For the sake of the record, let me repeat the very specific language that Jefferson used in his second inaugural address, a speech which was never delivered in the early America of Justice Black, Professor Commager, and Barbara Walters. This is a quote from the second inaugural address. In matters of religion, I have considered its free exercise is placed by the Constitution independent of the powers of the general government, by General Reed Federal. I have therefore undertaken on no occasion to prescribe the religious exercise suited to it, but have left them, as the Constitution found them, under the direction and discipline of state or church authorities. What could be more specific, more immune to misconstruction? In a formal and deliberative speech to the entire nation, Jefferson, surely the most latitudinarian of our early presidents, makes it quite clear who can and who can't prescribe religious exercises and where that wall of separation is to be built. Now, it's possible to argue that were he alive today, he might feel differently, though such an argument would be at best entertainment for a winter's night. It is also possible to argue that present conditions demand that we go further than the founding fathers were willing to do. But this is not what Justice Black or the popular press have persistently maintained. They have said things were their way from the beginning. They have told untruths about the American past, either out of ignorance or out of a fine contempt for the facts of history. And any nation which is so ideologically obsessed that it must sustain its present by lying about its past is entering into a state of communal madness. In a very real and clinical sense, we are going insane, and no one in charge seems to be prepared to do anything about it. Another promise that we want to hear concerns the outlawing of abortion by whatever means necessary. Indeed, this issue has done something that no one in our part of the country thought possible, the uniting of evangelicals and Roman Catholics in common cause. Here, the High Court has resorted to a kind of reasoning that Pascal confronted in the writings of the 17th century Jesuits, who said that a servant can help his master commit a crime so long as the servant takes as his aim the payment he will receive and does not favor the commission of the crime. A man can fight a duel so long as he simply goes forth for a walk at the appointed place and hour and then defends himself without accepting the challenge. A man can commit murder so long as his intention is directed toward the defense of his honor instead of toward revenge. Pascal's response: it would be better to have to do with persons who have no religion at all than with those who have been taught on this system. Likewise, of Justice Blackmun, one might say it would be better to have to do with judges who've never been to law school. Such logic, the kind used by both the French Jesuits and Justice Blackmun in his opinion on abortion, is not so much mad as it is wicked, a piece of casuistry which allows people to excuse themselves from actions which the traditional community has always deemed immoral. Nicely framed by subtle minds for a decadent age, such pleas as popular pieties. To the same purpose an old man serves wine to a young girl. To dull reason, to validate desire, and to blur the ugliness of what she is invited to embrace. Pascal's adversaries, the Jesuits, could not tell their flocks that there was no such thing as sin. Self-indulgent as they were, the penitents knew better. At the same time, the priests were too cowardly to forbid the powerful what they most desired. As a consequence, they provided rationalizations for sin, couched in the language of scrupulosity. Likewise, Justice Blackmun makes us all feel as if abortion were not only permissible, but an act of high moral purpose, sanctioned by the gods of equality and freedom, those ancient enemies who always seem to get along so well in the rhetoric of the federal judiciary. Yet what he was justifying was a practice that 30 years ago was viewed with disgust by virtually all decent people. Contrary to popular opinion, abortion was not considered sordid because it was performed in filthy back alley offices. Conversely, it was performed in such places because it was considered sordid. Americans have never hesitated to transgress publicly when they felt halfway decent about what they were doing. Prohibition is surely an example of that. Yet no crime was committed so surreptitiously as the murder of the unborn. And murder, it has always been, since a time beyond the memory of the first scribe who recorded the first case in common law. The awarding of damages to infants in the womb, charges of homicide against those who kill fetuses and attacks on mothers, even the sparing of pregnant. Put on this time by the National Republican Party. Given the choice, we'd rather believe in the reality of ghosts, water witches, as well as in the unreasonable doctrines of the Trinity, the virgin birth, the resurrection. If all of us don't believe that the Old Testament is literally true, every inspired word of it, we doubt only the big miracles, not the small ones like the parting of the Red Sea, Noah in the Ark, Jonah in the whale. We also believe in the law of gravity, the roundness of the earth, most of us, and the theory of relativity, which we neither understand nor consider particularly important. And we don't believe in these things the way Californians sometimes do, as a kind of subjective hedge against those rare moments when they're disillusioned with sex and drugs. We believe that all these mysterious truths exist outside of us. That the Ten Commandments, as well as the multiplication tables, are written in the unmistakable calligraphy of God across the very heart of being. But as credulous as we are, there are a few things we can't quite believe in, and one of these is the science of economics. I wish it were otherwise. I wish we were cleverer, more quantitative in our thinking. But alas, we'd as soon believe in alchemy or astrology. We'd probably find more merit in a pack of tarot cards than in the idea of the Lafleur curve, which God never heard of until he read about it in the public interest. When George Bush used the phrase voodoo economics, we objected not because we thought it was inaccurate, but because we thought it was redundant. And while we're perfectly willing to admit that First Amendment rights extend to economists, we probably would support a law which made it mandatory that when issuing statements on public policy, they'd be required to wear long sleeve gowns and pointed hats covered with stars and moons. All of this is by way of warning that in 1988 we will not support a Republican candidate who bases his campaign solely on the idea that whatever satisfies our pocketbooks is right and good, as well as practical. Besides our general skepticism, such a premise is an insult. You simply don't go around saying that people will do anything for a buck, even if you have the charts and diagrams to prove it. Since when did such vulgar sentiments become the rallying cry of both political parties? Since when did the Republican Party become the party of greed and the Democratic Party the party of envy? Surely this has come about within the last 30 years. And anyone who's over 50, can remember a time when nobody talked about money. Not in public, not in private, except for the lowborn or ignorant, who alas often stood for public office and sometimes won, particularly after the turn of the century, when decent people, at least in our part of the country, began to withdraw from the political arena in the mistaken belief that it was nothing more than a cockpit. Yet in 1984, everyone talked about money. About how much or how little people had, about how much more they stood to gain if they voted right. And even if we do respond to that kind of impulse more than we'd like to admit, it's wrong, morally wrong, a sin, to encourage the growth of this kind of attitude in an electorate. We want to vote for the party of virtue. So do millions and millions of Americans everywhere, north, south, east, and west. We will simply refuse to believe that our conduct or the conduct of others is motivated solely, by an immitigable selfishness, that God is nothing more than a cosmic wallet. Any party committed to that proposition not only underestimates the American electorate, but underestimates the entire human race. We don't want a politics of graphs and numbers, as useful as those engines may be. We want a politics of glory, and we will no more settle for mere greed than we will settle for mere sex, not if we can fool ourselves with some wild, hopeless, dream-ridden fantasy into believing we can have love as well. That's what the battle of will be fought over next time around. As a matter of fact, that's probably what the Battle of Armageddon will be fought over. We may be utterly astonished at just who's fighting against whom. But enough of these prophecies, which surely won't come true. Despite Hrothgar's warning, Beowulf lived a long life, most of it in office, in regal power, in full control of the plumb book. His faithful followers became cabinet members, ambassadors, chairmen of blue ribbon commissions. He ruled so long that he appointed 5 Supreme Court justices and saw a turnover in 80% of the civil service. His approval rating soared higher than any leader in the history of the Yeats. And he left his people with a huge surplus in the treasury. That isn't exactly what happened in the original, you understand. But for this occasion, it is what we all want to hear. Because, told this way, it sounds so good. Thank you.